History is not the study of the past. History is the study of the present. Mm. The past is your materials. It's your resources. But you're viewing everything through what's going on now, whether you want to or not. This is Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast that digs into the true stories behind everyday life to reveal the unexpected foundations of how and why we live the way we do. This season, we're going to get to the truth of what social constructs are by taking apart the most hotly debated, perhaps least understood social construct of them all, gender. From fish tacos to royally decreed school uniforms, these seemingly unrelated events reveal things you've always thought were incontestable facts are actually social constructs. Joining me, Dr. Andrew Johnstone, all season to separate biological fact from fiction is puppeteer, director, and generally brilliant co-host Alicia Britt.
Woo!
And of course, the queen herself, producer Naomi.
Hello.
We will be bringing out episodes every Tuesday, but if you can't wait that long, this whole season is available right now in full and ad-free at patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. Now, grab your Barbie doll and your golf putter. Get ready to enjoy Seemingly Unrelated. Hey, if you're just joining us this episode and haven't listened to episode 1 of season 3 yet, we really recommend starting there and taking the whole season in order. It's just easier that way.
If you believe in one God, do you imagine them as male or female? A question that has plagued humanity for decades, but surely no one in the modern world would challenge the idea that nature, in all its beauty and fury, is a mother.
Of course, nature is a mother. Women are the nurturing gender, right? They care for and they protect others, often to their own detriment. So why would the planet, Earth, and nature, which care for and protect all of us, much to its detriment, not also be a mother?
But has nature always been a mother? Have humans, in their 5,000 years of known storytelling about the primordial forces around us, always ascribed femininity to acts of creation and nurturing?
Are the roles of mother and father as we know them today embedded in our myths and legends for countless eons? Is there a theological reason, perhaps, that justifies the idea that men destroy and women create?
No!
No!
But let's find out more on Seemingly Unrelated.
Just remember strong and wrong, okay?
Strong and wrong.
We need to do more trying to speak together on the podcast. I think that's that should be the new niche.
So the quickest route to answering this issue is to just count up all of the creation myths and the deities from the natural world, specifically, across pretty much all of the oldest religions. So Mesopotamia, ancient Mesoamerica, and along the Yellow River in China, those are the sort of oldest places. Indus Valley gets a nice shout out as well. This Mother Nature concept, it doesn't hold up. Between thunderbirds and self-flagellating corn dudes in Mesoamerica, an earth monster who destroys, a female earth monster destroys rather than creates in Mesopotamia, and a long-standing debate between a lady who wears a phoenix as a hat and a gang of five dragons in ancient China, there does not exist any consistency in the gendering of ancient deities that are related to nature or birth or creation.
This makes plenty of sense when you realize that ancient languages in these regions didn't normally have a binary gender structure.
Yep.
East Asian languages like Mandarin and Japanese didn't even have gender pronouns until the introduction of Western literature.
Portuguese.
Meanwhile, the Aztec and Sumerian languages divided pronouns up into animate, alive or moving, and inanimate, dead or an object. The distinctions of gods versus goddesses in these ancient religions are either vague or added on later by Western scholars trying to understand old texts and scriptures with their own language.
Meanwhile, literacy and language consistency barely existed before about the 1790s CE. So that's 200 years ago, not 4,000 years ago, in most of the world. When telling the story of An and Ki, earth and sky, in ancient Mesopotamia, for example, this blending of Sumerian languages and Akkadian languages meant that sometimes An and Ki were husband and wife, and sometimes they were gender-neutral twins. Gross. Archaeologists discovered tablets a mere 10 miles away from each other, carbon dated to roughly the same time period, telling the story of An and Ki, and those texts don't even agree on the gender of those creation spirits.
It sounds like maybe these Europeans are screwing around again on this one.
I just hope that they weren't twins and wife and husband at the same time.
That's the gross. That's what I mean by gross. Thank you.
For this, please. Please and thank you, history.
I mean, I got to tell you, Naomi, history is not on your side with this one. It's not going to go well.
I don't like it when you say scary things.
I don't like it when you do history.
I want the history to be nice.
So, probably the most famous European creation mother god is Gaia. So, Al, Gaia. Have you heard of Gaia?
Gaia is... I have heard of Gaia. I have heard of Gaia from the video game Horizon Zero Dawn, where she plays the kind of... Yeah, there's a weird baby factory. You find it at the end of the game. Have you played this?
I've not played Horizon Zero Dawn.
Oh, it's really good. It's, like, super deep, actually. Yeah, and very uncomfortably relevant with the AI-powered robots taking over the world.
So, Guy is a giant robot baby-making factory?
Yeah, she's kind of like an AI system that kind of controls like where babies are born in the, yeah.
So obviously that means Gaia's got to be an Earth mother, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, because Gaia first appears in an ancient Greek text from about the year 800 BCE. So that's 2,800 years ago, written by a guy named Hesiod called Theogony. Theogony just means like the story of creation, basically. Mm. So when Hesiod outlines the creation of the world, he ascribes Gaia as the name for Earth. So indeed, Gaia means Earth, and Uranus for sky, not Uranus. I want to put that one out there. It's Uranus. It's not much better. Now, they are siblings because they have the same parent, which is chaos. So before there was a world, there was chaos. And chaos has never ascribed a gender. Chaos is like the void of non-existence, basically. So makes sense. So we may have noticed, by the way, this is just An and Ki all over again. So... None of these three, the original three beings of existence, are given a gender at first. Uranus will later be referred to consistently as a father whenever the Titans are discussed, because the Titans are the children of Uranus and Gaia. But Gaia is not called mother. And in fact, Gaia is always referred to using the Greek pronoun min. And min means he, she, or it in the ancient Greek language.
Cool.
Totally any kind of, it could be anything, right? And the only physical description of Gaia is that they are, quote, wide-chested or broad-chested, depending on your interpretation. What does that mean to you, Al?
That means both in equal measure. Everyone needs a bosom for a pillow, and some of my favorite characters from K-dramas when they're doing the scene in the rain with a white shirt on. You know the scenes.
I don't really know the scenes.
Yeah. Describe the scenes to us.
So you've got, you imagine you're there, you've got like, you're a cute little, perfect little K-drama lady, and it's starting to rain. And the guy there, he's like tall, he's got a Dorito-shaped body, white shirt. It starts to rain, and he like takes his shirt off and whips it over your head so he can protect your hair from the rain.
This is wow. I thought for a minute you were going to say the woman. I was like, I definitely feel like I associate it with, Dorito-shaped man. I think that's...
Yeah. My brother and I we're broad-chested gentlemen. We're barrel-chested, in fact, people would say. I've probably got the broadest chest out of the three of us, I would imagine. You could interpret it as a rockin' set of tits, but also it could be that it's just... You got broad shoulders. The only time, in fact, that Gaia seems to be ascribed any vaguely feminine identity in the Theogony is when a Titan or a god, almost always Zeus, gets sexually frustrated and masturbates under the ground, and their, quote, seed mixes with a bit of Gaia, usually creating some terrifying creature like the Cyclops.
See, that's like the history I don't like. I don't want to hear about that.
And is that supposed to represent the like natural birthing process? Because to me, it kind of sounds like Hesiod was bored and got distracted during sex ed. You know what I mean?
He doesn't know what's going on.
All of Hesiod's examples of Gaia giving birth are twisted creatures that abuse Gaia or create trouble. Kronos, the Cyclops, for example. And I mean, that's far more interesting than what we were doodling on our desks during biology.
I don't know. I was doodling some interesting stuff.
Even in a deeply paternalistic society like classical Athens, I don't think this really reflects the mother nature we hold in our hearts today.
Agreed. Because in the Middle Ages, things are a little bit different, right? Europe did have a load of languages with clear genders, mostly Latin, but also German languages. That German, of course, though, having, I want to note, three genders, male, female, and neuter. Just want to put that one out there, gang. And they also worship one mother who is iconic for her unwavering, nurturing character.
It's my nan, Hildy.
Maybe.
Picture a sweet little German old lady with hair styled like the queen. It's definitely my nan.
Okay. Possibly. Is there any other European figures it could be?
Oh, no. Wait. Of course. We're talking about the Virgin Mary.
That's right. Latin and German, they love that Catholic stuff. The cult of the Virgin Mary was established in the 2nd century CE, and it created this really weird idea that, like, Mary, who was a virgin when Jesus was born, lost her virginity upon Jesus's birth, but was so divine and wonderful, she re-virginized herself and remained a virgin for the rest of her life.
if you can just re-virginize yourself, does any of it mean anything? Do you know what I mean? You know
what? Fair point.
This or is if like, I just like leave the poor woman alone, like stop checking.
This yes, is stop it's checking. Weird. Yeah. This is so true.
Her son died. Let that woman, like, just be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But also the fact that you could lose your virginity giving birth to your own son is...
That's kind of... Yeah, I don't like that.
Nah. That makes the Holy Trinity seem like an easy concept to wrap your head around. Why they did this, we don't got time for that. But for the next 1,300 years or so, the Catholic Church specifically held up this idea that women who aren't virgins giving birth are unsullied creators. They're not as pure as the Virgin Mary who created Jesus, therefore God, therefore the world, in a pure state.
Yeah, Mary's pregnancy, I did pay attention in biology, and I'm pretty suspect to this whole, like, immaculate conception thing.
What do you mean? It doesn't pass water?
Yeah, I think if we're all aiming for that immaculate conception, then we might fall a little bit short.
It's an extinction level event.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little white lie to save a relationship that kind of got way blown out of proportion. And then came the Protestants.
Yay.
Getting rid of all the Catholic stuff meant the cult of Mary went with it, except that's never quite how Christianity does things, is it? Just like Christmas took a bunch of Roman traditions and made it about Jesus and Easter, took a bunch of pagan Wiccan traditions and made that about Jesus, some Protestants took the imagery of Celtic matrony and transferred Mary's pure creator status onto them. The matronae, while always being considered mothers, are these whole beings with entire lives, and being a mother is usually one or two paragraphs in their stories. They are mother goddesses, but it is their unusual relationship with the Virgin Mary that first creates the idea of a mother to Earth. But by the time Protestants and Catholics had stopped murdering each other, this whole concept pretty much faded away.
Now, fast forward to the 1970s, and for the first time, scholars actually start to study female deities in ancient religions quite seriously. This is a true fact. The first scholar to name all of the Mesopotamian goddesses was Samuel Cramer in 1976 CE. In his chapter, Female Deities, Victimization and Resentment, Cramer frames all the female deities as either being submissive and victimized, or rage-filled spirits of vengeance.
That is pretty... That this guy needs to watch Manosphere or something.
Right? Yeah, he thought he was woke, and yet it didn't quite get there.
You got some issues, man.
The reaction was a flurry of women who were joining academia at this time, and some of them joining academia because of Cramer's book, specifically honing in, studying how gender in the humanities, history, the classics, theology really worked. That really first wave of feminist scholars focused on women in myth and lore who are specifically not victims. And a lot of those ancient deities that were goddesses of creation or associated with Earth got their first mainstream exposure because of these goddesses. Those matronae, which the Protestants had connected to the Virgin Mary in order to dismiss the Catholics as just stealing from the pagans, got included in the mix.
So once the stories of Earth goddesses filtered out of academia and encountered the complex relationship between motherhood and women's liberation, there was a good place to put both, Mother Earth. Now, you too can be a strong, independent woman and a mother, because the Earth itself is a mother and it supports us all.
So I was reading through a lot of the literature on, like, the cult of Mary and on this connection, and a lot of feminist scholars, including most notably Simone de Beauvoir, they talk about this, like, not just the relationship between the Virgin Mary and creation, but the influence that's had on, like, this Mother Earth concept as being, like, quite oppressive, in that it's impossible for women to achieve that level of nurturing. Like, and so by setting, effectively, de Beauvoir is arguing that this institution has, like, set women up to fail so that they never quite feel like they are enough. And then the men, especially in the church, the men who are, like, celibate, they stand in judgment. They're like, you're not as good, you're not enough. And I was wondering, for the two of you, because this is just me reading scholars, what kind of experience you've had, if you've sort of felt maybe empowered by this concept, or if you've also sort of thought, boy, that's a lot of pressure to live up to being like Mother Nature.
To be honest, I feel less connected to the cult of Mary stuff, Virgin Mary, because I've always been an atheist. So I don't feel beholden to those standards. I'm sure it's seeped into my society, living in a Christian country. But interestingly though, Mother Earth, I do think, is something that has seeped into my consciousness, of mothers being, like, I always thought that made sense, that Earth was a mother and stuff, but it does put me in the position where I'm like, yeah, if Earth's a mother and everything's motherly, it's kind of giving all the good stuff to women, isn't it? Which I hadn't really thought about until I realized, I was like, yeah, why is that gendered? Like, men could be nurturing and caring.
I mean, it's giving you all the good stuff, but it's also giving you, like, the burden of everything, right?
And I also guess that, like, having to mother everyone is actually not ideal. You don't want to have to constantly be looking after people, because then I guess, when do you get looked after? I don't know. How do you view motherhood in that sense, Al?
Yeah, I as a kid, I never really, like, had baby dolls or, like, toy prams. I didn't really kind of get that thing. I don't know. I guess as I've got older, I've kind of, like, looked at myself and thought, like, I don't know. I find the idea of, like, carrying a child inside me kind of odd and, yes, not very terrifying. Natural feeling. Yeah, you know what I mean. And, you know, as you watch, you know, like, friends have families and things, you're kind of like, well, I don't look like them, or I don't act like them, and I don't feel the same way. And you kind of start questioning yourself, like, you know, is that because, like, I shouldn't be a mother? But I think, like, the more I've sat with it, the more I've realized, like, you know, motherhood can be a different thing. The relationship between you and your partner raising a child doesn't have to be binary. Like, you know, families are, whatever you make them, infinitely unique to each family. And I guess that's kind of where I stand now. I don't have to have a baby doll when I was three to, like, be a good mother. But at the same time, I think fathers can be really motherly, you know, as well, like, just the same.
I was going to ask Andrew, like, with you and Frank's non-binary, how does that affect, like, are you planning on parenting? Like, how does that affect it, do you think? What roles you're in?
Yeah, I think it definitely then impacts the way we would think about parenting. Because between the two of us, you know, I'm more maternal in a lot of ways than Frank is, you know?
That's so unfair that you can't grow it inside. See, even right? Saying it out loud sounds funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a thing where it's like, well, and I think, yeah, if I had a uterus and ovaries and eggs and all of the necessary bits, Sure. I would in that situation be more likely, I think, to have a quote unquote biological child. Mm. Whereas that's totally off the table. It's not how my physiology works.
So Mother Nature, obviously, that's why we're talking about mothering, but like also there is that other association with Gaia and stuff, which is the hippies and the crystals and things like that. So where does that come into it with the gender roles, do you think?
So I was just going to say about this because I love the, was it Mesopotamian we were talking about at the beginning?
An and Ki, the twins?
So like the five dragons and the phoenix.
Oh, that's
on
China.
Heads.
China has five dragons. Yeah.
So like when I was in Japan, there's this kind of incredible energy of like nature and natural forces being ready to strike at any time. And I love that for me as an artist, I feel like very much like a female, like a creator of things that's just like bringing things into existence. And also that like I'm kind of unpredictable. And I love the idea that Mother Nature, you know, can be kind and giving, but also kind of like, don't fuck with her because, you know,
she
what are you
going to
do when the lava comes? Yeah, exactly.
It is good. It's great that you mentioned specifically like Japanese animism, which is for, we've talked about on the show before, but people not familiar, the Shinto religion, which is like, interestingly, it's just a part of Japanese society. It's not like we would think of necessarily as religion necessarily. You don't have to like go to church on Sundays or whatever. It's just like accepted as part of society. And then other religions kind of lay on top of it, like Buddhism, Christianity in some instances. It depends on where you are in Japan. And so a big part of the reason why the hippie crystal mothers really identify with Earth Mothers is because hippies are in many ways this group of contrarians. They're like they're the logic lord internet bro trolls of the 60s. Their whole vibe is whatever they've been told in their life must be wrong.
Just anything.
Yeah. And I'm oversimplifying, obviously, but like the idea that like, oh, you know, you shouldn't have sex until marriage. They do the summer of love.
Woo!
Oh, you know, you should like cut your hair short and wear a suit and a tie. They're growing their hair out with beards and wearing like flowing peasant type clothes, right? All of they're rejecting this mostly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture that dominates, especially after the Second World War. And so where they go in a lot of ways is to East Asia to kind of mine for alternatives. And so like a lot of the hippie stuff is like Orientalism.
Mm.
Like we get the secret wisdom from the East. And so in places like Japan, which in the 1960s would have been accessible to hippies, unlike China, China under Mao, not accessible to hippies.
Nah.
Places like Japan do have this, like, every element of nature has an identity. So, like, that's why, like, hippies are, that's one of the inspirations they get from that is, like, we need to treat everything as alive.
Just a heads up. What I'm about to say about the Abrahamic faiths is not 100% accurate, especially when it comes to Islam. But I'm leaving it in because we're going to talk about that in the forthcoming 7th episode, the final episode of the season. So just, you know, don't listen to the wrong person, me, over the next few seconds. And we'll explain in more detail in episode 7. Sorry. Bye.
And then if you've been told your whole life that God is a man, because as we note in the Abrahamic faiths, the creator, the mother of all existence is explicitly male. Like you could disagree with it, which is fine. But like Jewish, Christian, Muslim God is a dude. in no uncertain terms. There's no translation errors there.
That goes way back.
That goes way back.
So it's like a rebellion for them
to rebellion.
Say like, women created the earth. Yes. I always seen it as like an empowering term that like, we get this one thing, you know?
We're just allowed give us nature. One thing.
Because all the men created everything else.
Men create all the bad things, right? And like, that's the thing.
We fix it.
History does kind of... When you read history, like... Women haven't been in charge, right? Kind of in most of the extant literature. So what's existing, what we can actually read. Matriarchal societies have been specifically suppressed in like the histories because it doesn't serve the people who are in power. So like there is this, if you've been taught that the history is of the world is the history of war, which is like even what my high school history teacher said was like the study of history is the study of war. Then yeah, you might be like, well, obviously if men have been in charge and history is war, men are destructive.
Hey, paganism had a lot of these like female ideas, but that was quashed by Christianity when it came around to introduce this cult of Mary thing and all that kind of thing.
And what's really fascinating is when you look at the Celtic pagan, which is the stuff I'm more familiar with, it isn't like more maternal. It's just that it's not exclusively paternal. So like when we look back, we look and go, oh wow, there's all these powerful, the matronae, like there's all these powerful women. And you're like, you mean like how
just normally, yeah,
just normal, yeah, just like yeah, there were like 10,000 people and like half of them were women and men roughly speaking, and you go, well then half of them will be powerful, like, you know what I mean, like it's just going to be split. It is absolutely by coincidence that we live in a patriarchal society. If you go far enough back in history, like it's been done on purpose for thousands of years, but like the ball got rolling purely by just it happened to be that men emerged as more powerful in this particular set of systems. And then that's what marched forward and dominated. This is a fact. We can reasonably estimate that in all of human history, there have been 100 million books written. 5,000 years of written history.
Yeah.
100 million books. Where do we hit the 50 million book mark?
So like the printing press was around in Bridgerton.
It was. It definitely was. Nice. Nice.
So like slightly after then?
That's pretty fair. Smart thinking. Gang? Gang? I want you to know.
I answered something completely different than that when I was asked it.
This is smart thinking that Al has correctly identified the printing press accelerated the pace of publishing, and therefore it's got to be after the printing press because people were like hand scribing before then. So here's the thing. We also know that since the year 2000, 70 million books have been published. So 26 years ago, only 30 million books had ever been published.
Wow.
And in the last 26 years, 70 million books have been published. Wow. So like that's 4,974 years, 30 million books, 26 years, 70 million books.
Wow.
So there's
not
this,
all
like,
of them good.
No, not all of them good. Actually, most of them trash.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating thing to think about because then you go, what have we lost in that, right? We've lost far more than we have in terms of history. Mm. So how could we be so certain? Like I've always told my students, the further you go back in history, the more interpretation and like the more you need to like caveat, this is the best we can do, which is not to deny that archaeology is a really advanced discipline that does incredible work. But like, to a certain extent, you go, do you know?
But this is, I studied archaeology at A-level, and pretty much my teachers, yeah, it was really cool. And my teachers were always just like, but we don't know this. After everything they said, but we're just guessing.
Yeah.
And there was like one teacher that absolutely, it's called Steve Nutt, and he absolutely hated, and he was a bit of a nutter. And he'd always gone on about how much he hated paganism. And it was just because he said that they always worship these old grounds, these ancient grounds. Like, they won't let the archaeologists dig up, like, Woodhenge or something. And they always come and worship these sites. But he was like, even we who study it don't know who these ancient people worshipped. This could be like an old toilet. Like, it obviously isn't. But he was like, we don't even know what it is. So how do they know that this is like an old worshipping ground? Yeah, you're right. Like, it could have been a matriarchal society up until that point. And we just wouldn't know. Or like, we're just ascribing so much like modern day thought to like these ancient gods. Like, as you say, they didn't even have gendered like pronouns, and we're going, yes, in the ancient text, Earth was a woman. And it's so interesting to hear that it's just like, we kind of could just
from the 70s.
Yeah. Gaia is always referred to in English translations as she, but if you actually go and talk to Greek, like ancient Greek linguistic scholars, they're like, well, within the context of so many different texts that do exist, min has, you know, is applied to characters that are referred to as father, characters referred to as mother, and to characters who are not ascribed any gender at all. So clearly min must have been just a bit of a catch-all until English scholars in the 18th century translate it, and they're already influenced, right? So they're already thinking about Earth as a mother because of the whole Mary thing. And I think, you know, Naomi, you really point at what's, I think, the essential like social construct element that we're getting to here, which is like, history is not the study of the past. History is the study of the present. The past is your materials. It's your resources, but you're viewing everything through what's going on now, whether you want to or not. And some people want to, right? Which is the Protestants in this case. They want to view the Virgin Mary, this cult of Mary, as being, we borrowed from the pagans, even though there's no evidence of that, right? That we can see. And people want Earth to be, hippies want the Earth to be a mother because it's contrary to the story that they were told, that God is a man and therefore men are in charge. So it's really important in making a social construct stick to go back and look at history and kind of cherry pick the sources that you like, and to look at them through your lens without trying to consider, okay, am I applying my own viewpoint? It's not that the people who translate theogony are misogynists necessarily. They might be. It's possible. But it's just that they weren't thinking like I was thinking, which is to go back and be like, wait, min, what does min mean? But then I'm also doing that because I'm specifically making an episode about how Mother Earth is not, you know, like, is not necessarily the situation. I'm going back and picking min up and being like, was min used to refer to women? Sometimes yes, but not consistently. So like, it's a big question mark.
So for this episode's interview, Andrew asked me to interview my mum, because we wanted to speak to a mother about her experience of parenting. The fun thing about my mum is she's also a nurse, so it's a perspective from someone that does a caring, nurturing role as well. So let's hear what she had to say.
So my name is Jan. I'm retired. My career was as a nurse. I've got three children, including Naomi, and went into nursing because basically I wanted to travel. So I didn't have any thoughts about this is the career for me because, you know, I'm a nurturing, caring person. It just seemed like a means to an end. And it just seemed like I was going to get paid for a job that was very flexible. It's quite an intense career. I quickly specialise in intensive care and, you know, it's quite serious stuff that you're experiencing every day. And so I just wanted a complete break and I went into public relations and marketing, which was great. But after about five years in, I started a family and it wasn't the sort of job that was easy to maintain having a family. And by the time the second child came along, I decided that actually I wanted to focus on full-time motherhood. And I was very lucky that I could make that choice. I never thought I was going to go back to nursing, having left it. But by the time you came along, Naomi, money was a bit tight. And so I did a return to practice course.
So it's all my fault that you went back into nursing, basically. But
well, yeah, you were a very expensive child, you know.
I think coming from the perspective of a child, I see a mother as a like comforting presence in your life that guides you. Yeah, someone that's always there for you, I guess. And I see that about both parents. I weirdly don't really see motherhood and fatherhood too differently. So what does motherhood mean for you?
I think that's lovely that you regard both mother and father as equally supportive. I think that's what you're saying there. You mm-hmm. don't distinguish really, and I think that's great. In terms of what motherhood means to me, I wasn't prepared for when I had our first child. I think there's something hormonal that kicks in as soon as you deliver a baby, that overwhelming sense of the need to protect. Basically, you'd put your life on the line before you let any harm come to that child, and I was totally unprepared for that. I was very open-minded before I gave birth, and afterwards I thought, oh my God, you know, this is, you know, that tiny being is totally dependent on me and I have to yeah. do everything I can to nurture and protect that child. And it's, I'm sure it's biological, hormonal.
Have you ever considered yourself more or less nurturing than dad?
So no, that's a difficult question, and that we're different people, you know, so I don't know how much is down to being male and female, mother and father, and how much is down to our different, you know, ways of approaching things, different personalities. I think because I gave up work for a period of time initially, you know, maternity leave, and there was no paternity leave back then. Dad couldn't give up work. He just had to go straight back to work. You know, I don't think he even got a day off, to be honest, apart from the day.
That's crazy.
So it was much harder for him. I actually really felt sorry for him, and I felt very lucky. I was with the babies all the time. He was only able to be with them in the evening and at weekends. So, but I always felt that Dad was totally on board with babies. You know, he loved you all from the outset. But it's very difficult to speak for him when he's not here, you know, to be inside his head.
But it's interesting to hear from your perspective. And I think that's such a good point about men not being able to be there as much due to like legal paternity, like rights as a father. And I guess that's a societal construct, isn't it, that's being created, that the women are the ones that stay home with the babies and the men yeah. go out. I don't think it was like as gendered the way you guys looked after us from my memory.
And I don't know, I don't think that was a conscious thing. It really, you know, I did very much feel like a partnership. Funny enough, in my own parents, they were much more traditional in their approach.
Yeah, granddad was very nurturing. I remember him being so amazing with like playing and stuff like that. But I don't think anyone would deny that Nana did all of the housework. And I don't think he would deny that either. That is just the way that society was laid out at the time.
In terms of witnessing those gender constructs, and Nana's, even though Nana was the one who was having to fulfill that role because that's the role that my dad put her in, she was very much, I don't want you all to carry on with these constructs. She was very much, I'm going to teach my sons to cook and make sure they do their fair share. You know, she very much felt she couldn't change it for her own personal situation, but she didn't want us to carry on those constructs. So I think probably it's a lot down to, you know, my mum, your Nana, that that didn't carry on to the same degree.
It shows you can reverse these social constructs if you teach your children differently.
Thinking about how Nana brought up her sons and what you've witnessed of your uncles, would you say that she achieved that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not there day to day, but I think that's true. My experience of growing up with you is she obviously passed that on to you. Mm. Because, as I said earlier, when I think of mothers, I don't think of them, their role being very different to the father. I think the mother and the father have the same responsibilities and the same job.
Something in terms of, you know, the roles that you've experienced, you witness from me and Dad, is you have to remember that Dad's father died when he was two. He didn't have a father figure. He just had a mother figure in his life. And so maybe that's why it's been easier that we don't, you know, we've shared things more, because he never had that traditional, like, this is the man's role and this is the woman's role. His mother did everything.
Yeah, so your societal constructs you learnt when you were younger would a bit more unusual.
Mm.
Where did you first experience the idea that you needed to be nurturing?
Now, that's a very interesting question, because I can't say that I consciously felt that I needed to be nurturing. It's probably much more a subliminal thing, message that, you know, that society gives you about women and mothers. But in terms of my own experience, you know, as an adult, as a mother, you know, I felt I was quite a career woman. I wasn't prepared for it to take over my life. I wanted, you know, I very much thought I was going to have my career, have children, and that's how I was going to move forward. I remember thinking at the time how lucky I was that I was the one that got to stay at home with the children, because that's what I wanted to do. I felt it was always a choice. I didn't feel I was forced into it. But not every mother feels that way. Not every mother wants to stay at home. And it's a very individual thing, isn't it, I think.
How do you see your role as a nurse influencing your role as a mother and vice versa?
I seem to remember that you and your siblings used to say, how were we so unlucky to have a nurse as a mother? Because, for example, if you'd hurt yourself, you had a cut, I would say, well, just get up and get on with it. You know, I wasn't particularly...
Yeah, you were very unsympathetic.
It's like, well, that's nothing compared to what I had to deal with last night or something.
Do you think you nurse differently after having children, or not really?
So I did look after children before I had children. In one particular intensive care job, we did take children, and I did see some very upsetting things. But I didn't have children at the time. And I know when I did have children and I wasn't looking after children, I was very thankful, because I don't think I would have coped very well, to be honest, because I know how it, you know, that feeling of being a mother and witnessing a child, your child going through something, I think it would have totally affected how I empathised. I think I was empathetic before I had children, but it's just a completely different ballgame once you're a mother.
We're talking this episode about mother nature. How do you view the concept of, like, nature being a mother?
It is true. People say that, don't they? And obviously that's come from somewhere. But I don't regard nature as a mother.
I think I used to see mother nature as, like, an empowering thing. Like, finally women get something good that they do is mother nature. But when I analysed it more when we recorded the episode, I was like, nah. For women to provide all life to Earth, I think that's actually, it's actually annoying more as it is empowering, because I guess it's just giving us more jobs to do.
Yeah, I don't think I want the responsibility that construct brings.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it, that just always falls to women, that role, and all the invisible work that women have to do. But is this weaponized incompetence? Have you heard that term, weaponized incompetence?
I've not heard that term, but I can imagine what it means.
The men don't see themselves as being capable of doing that role, and they make themselves worse at the role so that women have to take it on. So, like, they can't wash up. They're bad at washing up. They're bad at cooking. They're incompetent at everything. But they weaponize that incompetence to mean that the women have to take the stuff for them.
I can see that weaponized incompetence a bit in my own dad, in that, you know, it was like, couldn't even boil an egg. But funnily enough, my mum, when it's just my younger brother at home, my mum went out traveling the country. She had a consultancy job eventually, and my dad had to cook, and he did learn to cook, I don't think he did that weaponizing competence. He didn't say, oh, I can't do it. It's just like, that's not my role. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then, and then that's like, it leads to women having lots of invisible jobs. So like an example was that this man, I saw a woman online that said her husband was talking about nails being cut or something like that. And he was like, isn't it funny that children's nails never grow? I wonder when nails start to grow. Oh. And she was like, the children's nails do grow. I cut them. You just don't cut them. So it's that the women have this long list of everything they have to do. And then the men are just floating by, not even realizing those jobs are happening. So they wouldn't know how to help. So when they say, yeah, I can help you, it's like the burden of having to explain all the stuff they do is like harder than just them just doing it themselves.
Yeah, I can see how that situation arises, you know, men just feeling incompetent because the women can often appear so capable and they do the job without like sort of complaining to a degree. And so they just let them get on with it. But actually, there is a responsibility for the woman to say, actually, no, you need to do that too, because, you know, I'm just doing everything. But that's all very well if the man isn't claiming incompetence, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess that's what the whole argument is, that a lot of women are coming forward now and going, this isn't right that you don't cook enough and you don't clean enough. Yeah. And he goes, well, I don't know how to do any of it. And so...
And I think my own personality in that situation, it wasn't my own situation, but in that situation, I'd say, well, you better learn then, haven't you? I'm not doing it all.
There has existed in plenty of religions a wide variety of gods and goddesses. Sometimes the goddesses are creators of some sort, and even sometimes they are the creator, or they represent like natural and organic creation. There are also just as many of examples where that same role is a man, notably, as we said before, the Abrahamic faiths, which represent just about half of all worshippers in the world, they ascribe creation to a man.
Or non-binary twins, or five dragons, as it turns
five
out.
Dragons. Exactly.
Well, some would argue that highlighting these goddesses is a source of strength for women today. The connection established in the Middle Ages between femininity and caring, nurturing, protecting, creating all things was intended to frame women as weak. It's not possible to keep up with the Virgin Mary in purity, so here we are, failures, unable to live up to the standard of Mother Earth.
Once you then add in the fact that, you know, women do give birth, the baby comes out of women's, it was pretty easy to then take this awful narrative and say, well, it must be true. It must be biologically true. And that narrative of the divinity of nurturing simply grew.
But what if you're a woman and you just don't feel that nurturing, or you don't want to have a child? By making motherhood a divine status, this means not becoming one is defying God or the universe or whatever natural order is assumed.
And what if you're a man and you do want to be nurturing? Or you don't want to be destructive? Is there something wrong with you for not opting to be domineering? Are you cut off entirely from the process of creating life, as is offhandedly joked about, and therefore somehow you are a wandering failure of bitterness? Side note, gang, conception is a team effort, right? When we work together, we achieve the maximum greatness of humanity. And when we divide ourselves into opposing teams, we only cause trouble. If the miracle of creation is powerful and incredible, do we need to constrain it to one gender or the other? Ancient religions didn't do this. The vast majority of languages today still don't have binary genders in them. So why should we? that's our show for this week. We are not quite at the halfway point of season three, but it is, we're barreling towards the ending there. I want to thank Al for being on this episode, as well as all the episodes of season three. Al, if people want to find out where you're doing things, where should they go?
If you want to commission me to make you a giant Mother Nature walkabout puppet, you can find me at aliciabritpuppetry.co.uk.
This is excellent. I think I may commission one of those. And of course, got to give our thanks to producer Naomi for working the cameras and the microphones in a way so that they sound good, and also for her invaluable contributions. She creates so much. Naomi, where can people find things with you in them?
I was going to try and make my Mother Nature themed as well in some way, but I don't have any thoughts today. So you can find me on Instagram at Kaomi. So that's Naomi with a K in the front instead of an N, Productions. And that's it.
Yeah. And if you want to get the rest of season three of this show, plus seasons one and two, seemingly unrelated pod.com. That's a good place to go. You can click subscribe when whatever this you're looking on YouTube, there's a subscribe button. You're on Spotify, there's a subscribe button. Hit that button. The episodes will naturally occur. And of course, they've got bonus episodes. Al and Naomi may be in some of those bonus episodes, which are only available patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. Where you get the free episodes for free, and you can get the premium episodes. Thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully, you're all going to enjoy some nature, which is gender neutral, out in the world. And we'll see you next week for episode 4, where we're talking about men. So goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Coe. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly unrelated pod.com.